Good morning, and thank you for joining me on the Path to Liberty. I'm Michael Bolden with the 10th Amendment Center, and this is the show for Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. And today I'm talking about a guy that I should talk about much more by the name of Algernon Sidney. And generally, when we think of people like the founders and the old revolutionaries, we hear names like Jefferson and Otis and Adams and others. But the names they heard from were names like Locke, Montesquieu, and Sidney. And so on this episode, I'm going to cover some of the primary ways that Algernon Sidney influenced the American revolutionaries and their views and thoughts and actions, things like natural rights, government by consent, and the right to revolution. But first of all, before getting to that, a quick hello and a huge thank you to everyone who is here today, whether this is your first episode or you've been here for every single one since day one. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. I hope you're having a good day so far. While we allow people another moment or so to get notifications to join us on the live stream, I should point out that we're having a little trouble with that Facebook platform today. I don't think we've been kicked off yet. It might just be a problem with our restreaming multicasting service, but I've been working with since last night. I've been working back and forth with them on tech support. If anything, we'll be uploading the video to all the platforms that we can't live stream to like normal. Anyways, over on YouTube, we got a bunch of people saying hi in the chat. There's Haji in Southeast Michigan, Richard Banks in Fredonia, Kansas, Cheriton Farmer, Missouri, Dixie Strong, Liberty Revolutionary. Good to see you, buddy. Kristen Nunya and everyone else. I really appreciate you guys spending some time with me today. And I want to just start out with a few things that I know I've highlighted before in the past that I think are worth mentioning once again. Of course, to start off, that the American Revolution was actually something that happened before the War for Independence, before the shot heard round the world, before the British gun control program came in that really kind of escalated things, that led to the declaration of the causes and necessity of taking up arms in July of 1775. It was a change of the principles and the viewpoints of the people going back to, as John Adams wrote, 1761, and James Otis Jr.'s point that an act against the Constitution is void. Government is not the one that holds authority over itself, that determines the extent of its own power. If power flows from the people, as George Mason and so many others told us, when government violates the rules, it isn't up to the government to tell us whether or not it violated those rules. Anyways, things like that, as John Adams wrote in a letter to Hezekiah Niles in February of 1818, he said, "This radical change in the principles, opinions, sentiments, and affection of the people was the real American Revolution. A revolution was a change in the way that people viewed government and their role and the role of government, who was in charge, the top of the food chain, and the like." And Thomas Jefferson even got into this a little bit as well. Here in a letter to Henry Lee in May of 1825, he did not live too much longer after this, Mr. Jefferson. He was explaining basically that in the Declaration of Independence, he wasn't trying to cover new ground. That wasn't the goal. He wasn't trying to just establish new principles. What he was trying to do was take the commonly held viewpoints of the people of the time and put it out there for everyone else to understand and even learn from. Here's how Jefferson put it, talking about the Declaration of Independence. The object of it was not to find out new principles or new arguments never before thought of, not merely to say things which had never been said before, but to place before mankind the common sense of the subject. He said it was intended to be an expression of the American mind, and to give to that expression the proper tone and spirit called for by the occasion. He said all its authority rests then on the harmonizing sentiments of the day. So Jefferson, was his great work there was really just to recognize the views that the people were holding so widely for so long. And if we can go back, Jefferson, I think, thought the beginning of the revolution started in 1764 and 1765 with the Stamp Act. And Adams thought it really started with Otis up in Massachusetts in 1761. Maybe there's a little regional conflict for those two guys as well, who eventually became friends once again late in life. But he said the authority of the Declaration was the harmonizing sentiments of the people. It wasn't just a group of men that wrote this up. They were actually expressing the views of the people. He says, whether expressed in conversations, in letters, printed essays, or in the elementary books of public right, like Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, Sidney, etc. And that brings me to Algernon Sidney. If you're watching the video here, you can see it up on the screen, just an image of the guy. He was executed by the British, I think, in 1683 for writing, but not publishing, a book that challenged basically the divine right of kings. This is a precursor to Thomas Paine's Common Sense as well. And they eventually published the book. Like, they found, they did a search warrant. He was kind of, he was actually in government. He had been a politician for some time. But for whatever reason, they did a search warrant of his home. Whether it was a warrant under our viewpoint or not is a different story, but probably more like the modern monster state does it. I can't recall how that all played out, but they found this manuscript that he had written. And that was one of the biggest things that they used against him in his trial, that he wrote these things, put ink to paper that said them. Even though he never disseminated them, he had negative thoughts about the power of the people and the power of the king. And so they eventually published his works after his death. I think it was like 1698 when it finally came out. And there was a study done sometime in the 70s that only Cato's letters, Trenchard and Gordon, this is like 1720s, and Locke were more widely found in colonial libraries throughout the time of the American Revolution. So this is like the number three most widely read dude out there, or at least published. Here from a really interesting paper by Laura K. Semmel, Algernon Sidney and the American Enlightenment. She says, as with most martyrs, Sidney had the opportunity to save his own life on the eve of his execution by making the, quote, unreasonable and indecent trade-off of confession for freedom. So they gave him the chance, confess you were wrong and evil and you said horrible things. You can't publish what you wrote, so no one can actually judge what you wrote in your character by what you have to say. You just have to say that you did some evil to the king, and therefore you get freedom and you just give up your liberty. But damage to Sidney's reputation, she wrote, would be worse than ruin to him. And she quoted worse than ruin from him as well. So this is important to understand. And in fact, this is what made him a hero to the American Revolution. Some people seem to hold the view that basically this was the single most important fact about his life. This was a moral standard. He believed in something. He believed in liberty. And then they eventually got to read what he believed as well. And we'll get into some major points on that in a few minutes. But he was willing to sell his life rather than sell his principles. I'm not sure I could do that. I'm pretty sure I couldn't. But I never claimed to be that level of courageousness myself. Anyways, here's from a great paper published in the 1940s, Caroline Robbins. She said, Sidney's reputation in his own lifetime and thereafter rests on the impression made by his character and personality rather than on the success attending his political activity. So many people that they have up on walls in government-run school classrooms and things like this, these are people who are basically elected despots. People that were told that were the great leaders are always the ones with the most power, the most success in achieving that power. But Algernon Sidney was someone who totally failed to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish or what he believed in his lifetime. And he wasn't famous or revered for that. He was famous and revered for standing up for his beliefs no matter what anyone said they were going to do. Here, John Adams, for example, was such a great fan of Algernon Sidney that he was key in getting Sidney's personal motto adopted as the motto or the state seal of the state of Massachusetts. I've read that they're trying to get rid of it. Surprise, surprise. I'm not sure if it's just the design on the outside or the words itself. I don't have to read the Latin and screw that up, but it basically says, this hand, enemy to tyrants, by the sword seeks calm, peacefulness with liberty. And that was the seal of Massachusetts starting in 1775. And that was Sidney's motto as well. And here again from Laura, she says, the first public mention of Sidney's martyrdom, this is in the colonies, first appeared in the colonies in 1734. And those of you who are aware of some of the history of jury nullification might be familiar with this particular case. I should actually do an episode on it at some point. This was James Alexander's defense of John Peter Zenger against the charge of seditious libel. Alexander drew attention to the well-known fact that Sidney had been attained of treason for writing a book. Again, it was treason for writing something, not even sharing it. And that's why he was such a hero, which since the Revolution, the English Revolution, has been esteemed one of the best books of government in the English language. In times when men were murdered by color of law for doing and asserting the liberty of the subject against the arbitrary power. Now, Alexander got disbarred for literally challenging the commissions of the judges hearing the cases, and someone else ended up coming in, and this is a very famous jury nullification case. But anyway, so Alexander, a few years later, wrote about this in the Pennsylvania Gazette and actually helped explain to people what was going on, and this is how he put it. Sidney, the sword foe of tyranny, was a gentleman of noble birth, of sublime understanding and exalted courage. His trial was a pregnant instance of the danger that attends a law for punishing words. Punishing word. We deal with this so much today. Now, they're not punishing us to death, but they do. The opposition to a free flow of speech is very aggressive in this country. It's very aggressive in this society, probably in this world. And really, the solution to speech, in my view, and I know I've adopted this from someone else somewhere, whoever said it first, you have kudos on this. But the solution to bad speech is not to restrict it and shut it down, because that creates the Streisand effects. It draws more people to it. The solution is more speech, more freedom, and allow people to learn. And if they fail to learn what you want them to learn, that's not on you to make them ignore the stuff that they're not supposed to hear in the first place, supposedly not supposed to. So anyways, punishing words. Sidney, the British Brutus, they also called him the British Cassius, the warm, the steady friend of liberty, who from a diffusive love to mankind left them that invaluable legacy, his immortal discourses on government, that's his article, was for those very discourses murdered by the hands of lawless power. So Laura points out that most Americans were therefore exposed first to the legend of his martyrdom. Not until later did his theory become available to most colonists. And it was about 1740 they started publishing it and printing it, and then it got into a lot of the libraries and people were reading it. Thomas Jefferson, in a letter to Mason Locke Weems in 1804, so obviously had been around for some decades, that people have been reading and studying Sidney, and of course it influenced the Declaration of Independence, which I'll get to in a moment. Jefferson says it is probably the best elementary book on the principles of government as founded in natural right, which has ever been published in any language. Now, Jefferson did a heck of a lot more reading than any of us alive today, I would think, or pretty close to it. And this guy thought that Sidney's book was the best ever, as far as introducing people to the general principles of natural right and natural law. Here, Laura points out that Benjamin Franklin carried the book Discourses with him whenever he traveled. In 1770, Franklin used the words of the great Sidney's Discourses in a paper against slavery. He recommended Sidney, along with Addison and Pope, as required political reading. James Madison included as a list of books in a list of books proper for Congress that they should be studying in 1783. I will link to that in the show notes. All this stuff that I'm citing here and referencing, I will link to all of it in a section in the show notes. I publish a blog about 1 to 2 hours after the live stream is done, and you can find that over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty, and that way you can follow along with the stuff that I'm talking about in context on your own time. I did an episode last year, August of 21, Thomas Jefferson's favorite book on government, also covering this, and I don't think I covered it, it was just scratching the surface, so hopefully this is a little more of an interesting take as well, and both of them will work together. I will link to that in the show notes as well. And the reason I actually came up with the idea to do this wasn't, I read the Journal of the American Revolution more than most websites out there, allthingsliberty.com, and just yesterday, David Osterson, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, but he's got a bunch of articles there, published an article about Algernon Sidney and his influence on the American Revolution. And here's how David put it. When Jefferson asserted the Declaration's fundamental principles of natural equality, God-given, inalienable rights, government by consent, and the right of revolution, He relied heavily upon the noetic antecedents advanced by the political philosophers who preceded him. Of course, Locke, Cicero, Aristotle, and, well, of course, Algernon Sidney. And the principles, David writes, which Jefferson articulated in the Declaration and which had been earnestly argued in the vast body of revolutionary literature by the Continental leadership, thoroughly permeate the pages of Sidney's discourses. It was so widely used and so influential that the Caroline Robbins, who I just mentioned, her as a historian, she referred to the discourses as the textbook of the revolution for the American independence. So the textbook of revolution. So there are three main principles. I mean, there's more than this, and I'm not an expert on Sidney. Other people certainly are much better on this than I. But there are three main areas that I think were very influential: natural rights, government by consent, and the right of revolution. Let's start with the first. And here's how David puts it. The Declaration's self-evident truth, we would think, that all men are created equal is widely recognized as an indispensable value of the document and the revolution at large, although the sentiment it expresses does not originate with Jefferson and the Declaration. We know Jefferson even said this himself. He did not come up with any new ideas. He was expressing the views of the American mind. Arguing the point, Sidney himself draws on the views of his predecessors while also presenting his own enlightened notions, both of which helped guide Jefferson in writing the Declaration. Here are just some little snippets from the discourses. By nature, all men are equal. Pretty similar, right? Hayward, Blackwood, Barclay, and others do with one consent admit as an unquestionable truth the natural liberty and equality of mankind. Very, very similar sounding stuff. The equality in which men are born is so perfect, he put, that no man will suffer his natural liberty to be abridged except others do the like. And I'm not sure what that last line means, but it sounds pretty solid to me. In the discourses, David writes, Sidney placed no fewer than 8 separate references or discussions asserting, describing, and accentuating the idea that natural equality is the original and rightful condition of humanity. And there's a big point there because, of course, we're talking about in this particular presentation the argument against the divine right of kings. So somehow human beings are equal unless you're born to a particular family. And it really is, when you get down to it, unless you just happen to have more guns and loot to be able to do what you want despite what other people want you to do, that's really what oppression gets down to. It's the barrel of a gun and who can afford the most of them. So the idea that everyone was equal doesn't work if some people have some kind of a divine right to be a little bit more equal. Here again from Laura, she said, an individual in Sidney's Republic still retained power over himself, keeping, quote, to himself the right of ordering according to his own will all things merely relating to himself. So whatever is just going to not impact other people, whatever you're doing, you're cool, do whatever. And of doing what he pleases in that which he does for his own sake. He is a free man who lives as best pleases himself under laws made by his own consent. Always back to this consent issue, because you're really not free if you can't consent to something. And here's Sidney himself. He said, for every man has a right of resisting some way or other that which ought not to be done to him. So don't aggress against others. It's an early precursor to what we could call the non-aggression principle, the NAP today. And though human laws do not in all cases make men judges and avengers of the injuries offered to them, basically there is none that does not justify fighting back against the people who attack you. And here he is in a whole section. There's an entire chapter, section 5, to depend upon the will of a man is slavery. And that's also a precursor to things that Patrick Henry said in the Virginia Ratifying Convention. Show me that age and country in where the people basically put the fate of their liberty in the hopes of their rulers being good men without a consequent loss of liberty. This is my version, my paraphrase of Patrick Henry's more powerful words. But he's saying, soon as you depend on the will of other people, you're always going to lose your liberty. And Sidney here, back in 1680 or earlier, published 1698, He specifically said just depending on the will of another person is in and of itself its slavery, whether they do the things that you want them to do or not. This is a not a free people. It's a population on its knees begging for permission. And here's how Sidney describes it. For as liberty solely consists in an independency upon the will of another, so just your own free choice, that is liberty. And by the name of slave, we understand a man who can neither dispose of his person nor goods, but enjoys all at the will of his master. So even if you're just told, well, you need a permission slip for this, 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 that's not freedom. That's the will of your master. So it's not really liberty if it requires a government-issued permission slip. There's a lot of things that seem to fit that, doesn't it? Aren't there? There's tons of those. Anyways, so let's look over into consent now. Consent of the governed was a huge part of the American Revolution, the viewpoints. You know, what property or what liberty do I have if they can take my property without my consent? We heard people like Dickinson and Otis and Samuel Adams and many others repeat those types of views over and over. And here David points out that Sidney's discussion of the evolution and institution of civil government was more nuanced and complete, and it included everything Jefferson also communicated in the Declaration. In particular, the argument expounding upon the establishment and purpose of government is immediately recognizable, as Sidney explained both the progression and meaning of consent, as well as the purpose of government in relation to its critical function. So terms, Sidney used language, lives, lands, liberties, and goods. We hear life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, and property. But the way Sidney put it, very similar stuff, but also very influential. Lives, lands, liberties, and goods was the way that he described it. Hear more from Sidney. He said, by this means, every number of men agreeing together and framing a society become a complete body, having all power in themselves over themselves, subject to no other human law than their own. This is about consent. So if government does stuff that they're not authorized to do, then, well, that's not consent. All those that compose the society being equally free to enter into it or not, no man could have any prerogative above others. So this is, again, against the divine right of kings, but in many ways, as Jefferson and then Richard Henry Lee lamented some years later, well after this, an elective despotism is not the government we fought for. So merely just being able to choose your rulers is not a state of freedom. And I think that ties in very closely to how Sidney's taking things here. And he goes further. He says, the power which the prince has be given for the good of the people and for the defense of every man's private life, liberty, lands, and goods. Again, that's the only reason that government should even exist. And if it's not doing that, it shouldn't exist. And then there's a right to deal with that. Back to David, he said, Jefferson, of course, argued that government is instituted to secure the God-given, unalienable or unalienable, depending on how you prefer that one, rights of life and liberty. And the powers possessed by government are justly exercised only when they emanate and proceed with and by the consent of the people. Sidney advanced identical ideas, he writes, although on occasions he preferred the term nations. He didn't say nation state. Now, this is like, this is definitely nations as distinct from the term of nation state in place of the people or the governed. And of course, now we should talk a little bit about the right of revolution. Because that, of course, if we're talking about the revolution being a revolution in thought and then leading towards a war for independence, there was a right for the people to do that, certainly. And that's articulated pretty well in the Declaration of Independence. And here from David's article, the right to revolution forms, you guys really should read this article. It's some of it's kind of in depth and not super easy reading. But the way he breaks it down in different sections, it's really interesting stuff. Again, that's allthingsliberty.com is the Journal of the American Revolution. That I read pretty regularly. The right to revolution, David puts it, forms the core of the Declaration. If you think about that, that's what it's all about. Hey, these are the problems. Here's our grievances, your arbitrary government, etc. And, well, we're out of here, and we're willing to take a stand. And we know that Dickinson and Jefferson explained the reason why they were fighting the year before, July 6, 1775. The right to revolution forms the core, the apotheosis of which is captured by the notion that should government become pernicious or ruinous to its original and designed purposes, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. This same right occupies a prominent position in the Discourses by Sidney. Indeed, he considered the right exhaustively, returned to it repeatedly, and was adamant and uncompromising in his advocacy and support of it. And I believe it was around 1762 or so, James Otis specifically pointed out that he cited Locke more than Sidney, because although they were very similar in their viewpoints, Sidney was far more aggressive about and more open about the right to rebel or revolt. And now he thought rebellion was actually the wrong term, and I'll get to that in a moment. But he was far more aggressive on that than Locke was. And Otis felt it was a safer play to not get charged with treason as well in 1762 and decided to go that route. Anyways, Sidney argued, this is from Laura's paper again, that seditions, tumults, and wars were not always bad things. A little rebellion now and then is a good thing, according to Jefferson, right? The key questions were whether an uprising was just or unjust, necessary or unnecessary. So it's up to the people if they want to have an uprising. That doesn't mean it's always morally correct. You don't have to agree with it just because a mass of the people do something. There has to be a proper goal, but it's not up to the government to say. Rebellion, Sidney claimed, was not always evil. Further, the word was often used improperly. The word rebellion, he explained, came from the word Latin word rebellare, which meant to renew a war. Thus, she writes, unless there was an original state of war between the people and their government, the term should not be used. Well, then again, Benjamin Franklin at one point, and I don't have the quote handy, but he basically said there's been in all through history, in every state and kingdom, a kind of a war between the government and the governed. So I can see how some people could make the argument that it is a rebellion. Anyways, she goes on and says, Sidney went to great lengths to justify rebellion. These seditions and wars and tumults were sometimes necessary to protect an innocent citizenry from an absolute monarch who exceeded his bounds of power. So not really, that's kind of an oxymoron. You can't be an absolute monarch if you have a limit on your power. And even the British kings at the time that James Otis said an act against the Constitution was void, clearly there were limits. And I would say the executive branch of today is far more powerful than what they rebelled against back then in the 18th century. Anyway, she continues. Sidney asserted that, quote, the people have not merely a right, but also an obligation to disobey bad laws and to depose or kill a tyrant. You see why this guy was put to death for treason. I could see how we could get banned from streaming by saying these types of things, literally just reading historical documents and papers like that, because free speech is so hated in this society today. Anything that challenges the established system, the established order, the monster state, the empire, they really don't like it. But that's the people not only have a right, but an obligation to disobey bad laws. Sidney, and I'm just off the top of my head, I know I've quoted this many times, that which is not just is not law, and that which is not law need not be obeyed. Resist the first approaches of tyranny. I'm wearing the t-shirt. That's how Mercy Otis Warren put it so many years later, almost a century later. To Sidney, Laura writes, there were so many things worse than resistance, it seemed impossible that the right to rebellion could be denied. Now, of course, I did an episode on Thomas Jefferson's famous statement of a little rebellion now and then is a good thing in response to Shays' rebellion in early 1787. I will link to that episode as well in the show notes, 10thAmendmentCenter.com/path to liberty. Some people today will just kind of hammer, oh, Jefferson was a kind of a whack job. He was out of the country, whatever. But we can see the lineage of where this came from. This was part of the American mind, as Jefferson was talking about in the Declaration of Independence, because it was part of Sidney's thought. And this was very influential on the founders and old revolutionaries. Here's how Sidney puts it. He's basically taking the position that When the people rise up against their government, this really isn't a rebellion. He said, those who seek after truth will easily find that there can be no such thing in the world as the rebellion of a nation against its own magistrates, and that rebellion is not always evil. So the short version, if the people are doing it, it's not rebellion, because the people are the fountain of all power. Now, that doesn't mean they're always right, because we know that, you know, mobs and things like that can do horrible things, and that it is not always evil. So he's kind of pointing out that maybe a lot of times it's evil, or a significant amount of time, but it really is not up to the government to make that determination. There's a higher power that does that. He said they cannot be said to revolt or rebel against them to whom they owe no more than seems good to themselves, and who are nothing of or by themselves more than other men. And I don't know if this influenced him personally. I'm not that much of a student of Lysander Spooner, the great anarchist writer of the 19th century. He wrote a lot about the Constitution as well, more than what most people ever talk about from one single meme. But one of my favorite papers of Spooner was his 1850 Defense for Fugitive Slaves. And it's a very similar type of a viewpoint here, that resisting government in even a physical way when necessary, rather than just a mere noncompliance. Of course, we know that Sidney said noncompliance is essential. James Madison in Federalist 46 told us that we should utilize a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union to keep government in check. But when those things don't work, you have to up at a level and up at a level and up at a level. And over time, you just keep going with that until you can put a stop to the violations of liberty. And Spooner had a very similar take, that this is how you keep government in check. And it's an unlimited right of the people to do that should they want to. And here's how Spooner put it. And again, I don't know if he considered Algernon Sidney an influence, but it sure sounds like that. He said, this right of the people, therefore, to resist usurpation, and we know usurpation is a theft of power, an exercise of power not delegated to the government. So to resist usurpation on the part of the government is strictly a constitutional right. And the exercise of the right is neither rebellion against the Constitution nor revolution. And that's, so I was reading through this again, reading these notes and the article over at Journal of the American Revolution. And I'm like, dude, this sounds so much like Spooner. I just don't know. Maybe someone who knows his work better than I do would be able to explain to me the exact lineage or Spooner ever cited him. But maybe I can just command F at some point through a couple of his papers. So the exercise of this right of resistance is neither rebellion against the Constitution nor revolution. It is a maintenance of the Constitution itself by keeping the government within the Constitution. And Spooner, this is my favorite part, it is also a defense of the natural rights of the people against robbers and trespassers who attempt to set up their own personal authority and power in opposition to those of the Constitution and people which they were appointed to administer. Now, Sidney said, you know, this is really, it's an unlimited right of the people to be able to resist government should they want to. But that doesn't mean it's always just, again, and it doesn't mean it's always the right choice. But he says this, I will not take upon me to enumerate all the cases which this may be done, but content myself with three. So there are basically three main areas where he said this was a justified response. The first, when one or more men take upon them the power and name of a magistracy to which they are not justly called. So people who are put themselves in power when they're not supposed to be there. The second, when one or more being justly called continue their magistracy longer than the laws by which they are called do prescribe. They don't leave office. Don't run into that too much. But the third one is the one I think we face the most today. When he or they who are rightly called, so they're supposed to be there, they do assume a power, though, within the time prescribed. They're there just as long as they're supposed to be, but they assume a power that the law does not give, or turn that which the law does give to an end different and contrary to that which is intended by it. So just a usurpation of power, an exercise of power not delegated, or to take a delegated power and twisted it around. Let's think about the power to declare war. That is to change the state of things from war to peace. If someone attacks, someone starts a war, then that's already been changed by someone else. But if that doesn't happen, it's only on the Congress, the representatives of the people, who have the ability to do that under the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. But instead of doing that, they've taken a power delegated to them and they've twisted it. They've used it in different ways. They basically said, we'll leave it up to the executive branch to make that determination. That's basically what they've done for decades and decades and decades with authorizations to use military force and all kinds of other stuff. So these are the ways that Sidney thought it was justified. Anyways, here's David again. Sidney's expositions on the right to revolution were strongly reflected in everything Jefferson wrote in the Declaration on the topic and were immediately pertinent to the specific historic circumstances of the British American colonies. They also gave Jefferson and the colonists everything they needed in order to morally and intellectually shield themselves against recriminations of treason and rebellion, if not from the British Parliament and monarchy, then at least from the existing international order. And that's partly what Jefferson was doing in the Declaration of Independence as well. Here, just to wrap it up, this is from Benjamin Franklin's Poor Richard Improved, 1750. So we know that discourses really weren't widely printed in the colonies until the 1740s-ish. And here's how he put it. This on the 7th of this month, so I think it was December, 1683, was the Honorable Algernon Sidney, Esquire, beheaded, charged with a pretended plot, but whose chief crime was the writing an excellent book entitled Discourses on Government. A man of it admirable parts and great integrity, Thompson calls him the British Cassius. Well, I hope you guys found this interesting. I hope it made you think. I hope it was educational, more important than anything, of course. I hope you learned something. We really want to get this type of foundational message out to more and more people, and nothing helps us get that job done more than the financial faith and support of our members. Please don't feel obligated to pitch in any cash, but if you've got any of that government fiat that they're devaluing and destroying every single day, throw it our way, and we'll use that dirty fiat to take a stand for the Constitution and liberty, whether the people in power want us to or not. You can join us over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/members for as little as $2 a month. I'm going to probably check this because I'm rambling a little bit long and I got a bunch of stuff to do today. I'm probably going to check over in the live chat. I see some comments from Haji and Sharon Patriot, Bonehead, Dixie Strong, Liberty, a bunch of people leaving comments. I'm sure there's a lot of really interesting stuff. Someone said RP should have been POTUS. That's cool too. But I will read through that a little bit later today, so please continue leaving comments, whether it's live or in the archive. That does help trigger the algorithms of the platform. So do reviews on Apple Podcasts or any other podcasts, sharing the links, subscribing, getting notifications. All that stuff will help spread the word. Again, I really appreciate you spending some time with me today. I hope you enjoyed the episode and learned something. Again, I'll be publishing a blog post for this episode in a couple hours over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty, and I will see you on Friday. For Fast Friday, here on the Path to Liberty.